growing number of children are diagnosed with ADHD, autism spectrum disorder, and bipolar disorder every year. And we will talk with a psychologist this hour who says doctors are mistaking ordinary childhood behavior for disorder and medicating rather than looking for fixable root causes. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will welcome in the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. And we will welcome your questions for him. Has your child been diagnosed with any of these disorders? How concerned are you about healthy kids being misdiagnosed? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Enrico Naulati, a clinical psychologist who specializes in child and adolescent therapy and assessment. His work has been published in many publications, including The Atlantic, Salon, The New Yorker, and he is the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So what do you mean by back to normal?
What do I mean by back to normal? I mean, it's my rather provocative way of saying that, you know, I think that there's a sort of we need to awaken ourselves to how there's so many normal behaviors in children. Normal behaviors, I would say, maybe in children who just struggle for ordinary reasons, that is likely to get diagnosed as a mild case of something these days.
Yeah, so what normal behavior might be mistaken for ADHD?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to spell out that so many of the so-called symptoms of ADHD parallel just run-of-the-mill childhood behaviors, like being able to pay attention, sit in your seat, stay in your area, wait your turn, refrain from having a wiggly body and being fidgety, finishing difficult tasks, seeing them through to completion. These are essentially, you know, the criteria for ADHD, but they're also, I think, run-of-the-mill childhood phenomena that so much so that if you don't have a clear understanding of really what's normal and expectable in children, that you can assign a diagnosis to a child inappropriately.
Yeah. What about autism spectrum disorder? What normal behavior might be mistaken for that?
Well, these days we're assessing children for autism spectrum disorder at younger and younger ages, which on the one hand I think is a very good thing, because the earlier we can catch it, the better we can treat it. But there are risks involved in assessing children at younger and younger ages, especially during the toddler years, because there's so many behaviors that are that struggling toddlers exhibit that are autistic-like. So, for instance, and this is especially the case with boys, so things like, you know, not looking up when your name is called, preferring to play alone than with other children your age, preferring to play with objects and toys than other kids, having difficulties transitioning, having kind of rigid food preferences. I mean, these are all very normal for toddlers. These are very normal behaviors for toddlers to exhibit, especially boys. But at the same time, they're also autistic phenomena. So if you don't really appreciate the distinctions between what's normal and expectable during the toddler years, once again, you can inappropriately assign a diagnosis of autism to a child.
And children are being diagnosed with bipolar disorder as children?
That's correct. Yeah, there's been a 40-fold spike in diagnosis of bipolar disorder over the past decade, and that's partly, actually, I'll say more than partly due, largely due to a change in the criteria for what is considered bipolar disorder. So, for instance, in the old days when I first got my training, mania or manic behavior, bipolar disorder used to be called manic depressive illness.
Right.
So with bipolar disorder, it used to be in the old days that mania was, you know, it was things like, you know, like being grandiose and having a kind of a larger than life image of yourself and what you were capable of, but delusionally so. You know, having boundless energy to the point where you may go for 2 or 3 days without sleeping, being highly impulsive, taking risks that can endanger oneself. These sorts of things. We're talking really alarming, crazy behavior, if you will. But about a decade or longer ago, mania was defined, redefined in children as irritability. So all of a sudden, kids that tantrumed, got agitated, had a quick fuse, all of a sudden they became categorized as bipolar disordered, and that largely explains the spike that we see in kind of kids that became sort of moody, argumentative, irritable, and tantruming being assigned a diagnosis of bipolar disorder.
Yeah, so what's the problem with the potential of misdiagnosis here, that we're saying that this ordinary childhood behavior is instead ADHD, autism, or bipolar? What is the harm in this?
Oh, there are lots of reasons why this is problematic. I mean, there's the obvious ones that you know, in a time of sort of cost cutting and changes in our health delivery system, that money and resources will be used inappropriately to treat diagnoses that kids don't have, money and resources that would be better allocated to really beefing up and bolstering services for kids that really do have these disorders. So there's that. There are lots of things that parents are unaware of that they should be aware of, so that they're when a diagnosis is assigned to their child, that might be a questionable one. So for instance, there's still strong stigmas in this country attached to mental illness. There's a study in my book, Back to Normal, that I cover that shows that, you know, upwards of a third of Americans still believe that an ADHD child is a would-be dangerous child. There's lots of occupations and careers that are off-limits to children that then grew up with these diagnoses, if they have that in a record somewhere, careers in law enforcement, the military, you know, you can't get a pilot's license if you have a mental illness, health insurance, that'll change, but disability insurance, life insurance policies can be denied, or you can have higher rates. There's states around the country where you can't get a trucking license if you have a history of mental illness. There's even, believe it or not, it was in 2010 in the state of Kansas, you could still be denied your voting rights if you had a mental illness. So, you know, there are these drawbacks, especially in the internet age where in competitive hiring situations, employers are scanning the internet, trolling the internet for any information they can get on and prospective employees, and if there's a casual reference to or records, you know, of a previous diagnosis of mental illness, that can disadvantage a child as they grow up.
Yeah. So why do you think it's being overdiagnosed? Why do you think doctors are mistaking normal behavior for abnormal behavior?
And I cover a lot of those reasons in my book, Back to Normal. But some of the main ones, believe it or not, is that health professionals and mental health professionals these days have limited background in their education and training in child development. If you look at the coursework they take, they often are trained and educated to see abnormality and not fully appreciate normality in children's behavior. So, and what in my profession and in the field of psychology, most of the, even for those that do have a background in child development, oftentimes it's a textbook knowledge, not flesh and blood experience. And especially the 21st century, maybe childhood is changing. Maybe the way children, normal children, behave under stressful conditions is changing. I would argue that, such that now, you know, if you don't keep up, if you will, with kind of how normal children behave under stressful circumstances, then as a health or mental health professional, you can kind of confuse what is normal with what is abnormal.
So how can the professional, or how should the professional tell the difference between normal childhood behavior or whether it's actually disordered?
Well, part of the answer to your question, John, is that for starters, I think that professional should take the time to really get to know that child, to really get rich descriptive information about how that child behaves at home, at school, at church, in the community. Sit back and listen. Sit back and get descriptive information. Unfortunately, in this day and age, especially in a pediatrician's office or even in a psychologist's office, I dare say, oftentimes there's a time crunch. The average pediatric visit is 16 minutes right now in the United States. Oftentimes there's the pressure to cut to the chase, and parents come in with, you know, a shorthand clinical information about their child, like he's impulsive, he doesn't listen. There are usually symptom-focused kinds of information. So the parents come in ready to speak in shorthand like that, and with the time crunch and the type of training professionals have, they're maybe only too willing to shrink the discussion, curtail the discussion, make it symptom-focused, instead of sitting back and really getting to know that child to see how they behave in general and not rush to diagnostic conclusions.
Our guest is Enrico Naulate. He is a clinical psychologist who specializes in child and adolescent therapy and assessment, and he is the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. And we welcome your questions, concerns, experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking this hour with a clinical psychologist, Enrico Naulate, who says that many doctors today are mistaking ordinary childhood behavior for disorder and medicating rather than looking for fixable root causes. And we're welcoming your questions, your comments for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. His new book is Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. Let's go to the phones. Mary in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is such an important topic. I work in early childhood, and I work at a child care center that's pretty rare these days, and that we still really value outdoor play time for children. And so the children in our program are out about an hour and a half every day playing in nature. And we're finding our waiting list is growing longer and longer, and it's a disproportionate number of boys that are on our waiting list who have been in other programs and have been started to be diagnosed or sent to the pediatrician for things like ADHD, merely because the curriculum is just way too sedentary and calling on them to focus way too much for their age and not allowing them enough fresh air and exercise.
Mm-hmm. Enrico?
Oh, I'm so glad that you bring that issue up. I mean, that's one of the central points that I make in my book. Those are not just observations that people like me and people like the caller are having. There's actually research out there showing that probably upwards of 1 million kindergartners are being falsely diagnosed with ADHD just simply as an artifact of them being the younger in age in kindergarten and being confronted with academic demands, cognitive demands in the kindergarten classroom, like the downwards extension of the first grade curriculum into kindergarten, and being disallowed opportunities for active play, and as a consequence of them being younger in age and the mismatch there, that they're being diagnosed with ADHD. So I think this is actually kind of a national problem, if you ask me.
Well, yeah, Peter on Facebook says, this has been our experience. A key indicator is ADHD is disproportionately diagnosed in boys who are young for their grade. So apparently that's what you just said there, that there's...
Yep.
What's going on here? Is a teacher maybe saying to a parent, Billy's really acting up in class and I think he has ADHD, and then the doctor says yes, and then Billy gets Ritalin, or how does that work?
I mean, that's typically how it works, but I don't want to unfairly target teachers. If think about it, it's much easier and convenient to focus on the child and what might be going on in their brain, so to speak, versus what is going on at the national level in terms of how we're structuring young children's educational experience. Mm-hmm. That is a much harder thing to change. And this is America, after all, and we're more prone to look at kind of individuals and individual responsibility and not the complex interaction between just sort of individuals and, and social factors. And I think that's one thing. It's easier to change or focus on the individual child than the complexities of an educational system that definitely needs to be changed.
We have another caller, Jacob in Viroqua. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. I would really like to thank Dr. Salty for the book. I was part of the way through reading it and heard of this program, so I actually called his office to talk to him Monday. I have a 6-year-old boy who was just recently assessed with ADD, and his mother's convinced that he has the affliction. And I was wondering what I can do to combat that, and I was also wondering if there's any psychologists in this region that he would know of that would share the same belief.
Yeah. Jacob, thanks for your kind words on your email, and I felt bad in not responding. Unfortunately, I'm getting kind of a ton of emails and calls. This book seems to have touched a nerve nationally, and I wish I could respond to all of them, and I wish that I had a rich network of professionals across the country that I knew of that sort of shared my same perspective, but I don't. I mean, I suppose the only advice I could give to you, Jacob, would be, here's a bit of advice, that if your son behaves ADHD-like at school but not at home, or at home but not at church, and you, or when he's with you, he's un-ADHD-like, but when he's with his mother, he is ADHD-like, then he doesn't have ADHD. So these disorders... kids don't exhibit them. There's not fluctuations like that. Like you've got a friendly teacher who's firm. The kid is un-ADHD-like, a more scattered teacher who's loose with rules and whatnot and reactive emotionally. The child behaves ADHD-like. Then we're not talking about disorders here. We're talking about, other things. Just normal childhood tendencies, behaviors that need to be better managed, better disciplined, and so on and so forth.
Jacob, thank you for the call. Isn't there, there are some children who have ADHD, right?
Of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am not at all in my book, Back to Normal. I do not question the legitimacy of these diagnoses. What I am proposing, though, is they're massively overdiagnosed. And part of the problem has to do with that we've expanded the criteria. We speak about them at the public level in such a folksy, casual way, so much so that a lot of, so we're more apt to kind of consider mild cases instead of looking at what is on the outer edges of normal. But these diagnoses definitely exist.
We are talking with Enrico Naolati. He is the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. He is a clinical psychologist who specializes in child and adolescent therapy and assessment. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is Joni in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Joni, you're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank you, and I hope that this changes the trend that we are involved in. I've been an educator for over 40 years. I started with working with very disturbed kids. I'm now working in a regular classroom. What I see is just exactly what you're saying. People are using these labels as some kind of excuse for not providing individualized instruction to everyone. I have a group of ninth graders now, and, well, if it was a swimming class, you would not put the non-swimmers with the swimmers, but because it's an American history class, we're all together, and some kids still can't keep their legs quiet. It's not abnormal. It's being a ninth grader.
Mm-hmm.
Some kids, yeah, they can't stop touching each other. It's not abnormal. It's being a ninth grader. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point, Johnny. You know that once again, you're bringing up this issue of you know, if you confront children of various ages with unfair academic demands. Unusual, like expectations to keep their body still, even, then it can create a symptomatic child or a stressed child that then, you know, raises the index of suspicion that they might have a diagnosis when they don't. Just a final point, there's some research that I uncovered recently that showed that the rates of ADHD went up 22% within 4 years of the passage of the No Child Left Behind Act, which is concrete scientific evidence to show that the diagnosis of ADHD it can be inappropriately diagnosed. When, as a function of just changing academic demands in the classroom.
Mm. We had Jacob, who was concerned about his son's diagnosis of ADHD, and I should have probably followed up. If a parent is concerned that their child is being diagnosed with ADHD or bipolar or autism. And in fact, I have an acquaintance. I swear, all three of those were diagnosed in the same child. And should they just accept? Should they debate? What advice do you have for a parent who is facing this situation?
It's a good question. I mean, and it's unfortunate, but it may be the parent in the doctor's office who has to take on the responsibility of being level-headed. I mean, that sounds absurd for me to even say, but to ask, you know, to hang on to some vision of normalcy in their child and to kind of confront the doctor with that. Like, but you know, he behaves this way with his dad, this way with me. Mm-hmm. This seems to fit with what you're saying about these disorders. This doesn't seem to fit. So the parent may need to get in an advocacy role to, like, really challenge any distorted or partly distorted images that the doctor may have of the child.
Yeah. David in Sturgeon Bay is with us. Hi, David.
Joy and Doctor, what a great program you got going on this morning.
Well, thank you, David.
Thanks.
Do you have a question or an experience to share?
Yes, I was the mental health program director in Door County for 30 years and was the conduit for children diagnosed with ADHD, either to our psychologist or our psychiatrist. And a couple comments I heard this morning were from teachers, and the conduit is generally from classroom behavior to a parent, then to a pediatrician. And generally what we see then is children who are medicated, and sometimes the behavior continues. And I have often questioned what is ADHD and what is poor parenting, and just the general consensus about what normal behavior is. And just because it can't be contained in the classroom, or because a parent doesn't know how to manage behavior in the home, it becomes the child then becomes the focus of the pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And when a family closes their door behind them at night, we do not really know what goes on in the household, or we would presume that it's good parenting, but I will conclude that it is not always good parenting. So I'll take any comments off the air. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thanks for your comments, David. You know, I see where you're going with that remark, you know, but I actually happen to be one of those professionals that have a great deal of empathy for parents, and my experience in my office over the past 10, 20 years meeting with parents. Most parents really crave help, want to be better parents, but with a focus on ADHD and disordered brains and treating the individual child that seems to go on in the mental health field, many professionals that work with children don't want to meet with parents, see parents as part of the problem, separate the child from parents, take them back to the office, such that parents are left stranded oftentimes at the very time that they need concrete help and crave concrete help in terms of how to be better disciplinarians, to appreciate the basics of family life, like good sleep routines, good appetite, good structure within the home. We've deprived perhaps a generation of parents of just getting important information out there on, you know, what is the high watermark of parenting. There's no gene that we're born with for being good parents.
Thank you, David. Amy in Waukesha is with us now. Hello, Amy.
Good morning. I am a mental health counselor on a college campus, and what I guess I've come to appreciate is the discussion that's going on with my colleagues around the state talking about how many students, the explosion in the number of students who are coming to our campuses with diagnoses. And I think that some of that is because things are being better diagnosed and there's maybe a slight decrease in stigma over the years. I've only been in this field for about 6 years, and what I am seeing in terms of the discussion today is that students who come to us on campuses and they have been inappropriately diagnosed, they have come to take on that identity as, I am bipolar and these are my behaviors, and it's been a little bit more challenging, I think, to work with them on that end. Specifically this year, I'm working with a student who I absolutely cannot agree with the diagnosis of autism that the student received, and it's really been a challenge to say, let's look at this in a different way. These behaviors don't match up with the diagnoses. And so they just really take it on, and it's very hard for them to look at it in a different way when they're now 18, 19, 20 years old.
Interesting. Dr. Nalati?
That's a terrific point, Amy, that you make, and you know, that there's the issue of like a self-fulfilling prophecy that if a diagnosis is assigned to a child, and that child is the professionals who are helping him or her, and that child's parents really believe it to be true and work off of that diagnostic script week in, week out, year in, year out, then yes, it could be that then children grow up to be young adults who believe literally that there are limitations to what they can do with their lives. And to me, that's actually one of the tragic dimensions of misdiagnosing or falsely diagnosing a child over time.
Yeah. So, what is wrong with medicating children if they're, you know, healthy, if they're normal, but it fixes this disruptive ordinary behavior?
Yeah, it's a good point, and I'll put my biases right up front. There's a part of me that likes where you're going with that question, Jai, and so if medication helps a normal but struggling child function better, why not? Why not take the medication? The problem there, Jai, is an ethical one. The FDA does not approve medications to improve children's functioning. They approve medications to treat illnesses. So when you start to go down that road of, well, hey, you know, so what if, so he has trouble concentrating in math class but not in history class. Why doesn't he take a kind of a you know, some Ritalin early in the morning when he has his math class and get better grades? Now we're in a very shady ethical territory, I would say, where we're giving certain children a performance boost with medication, and should we be doing that?
We are talking with Dr. Enrico Naulati. He's a clinical psychologist, and he is the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. We welcome your questions. Are you concerned about healthy kids being misdiagnosed? Has your child been diagnosed with any of these disorders? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder, Dr. Enrico Naulati. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you would like to join our conversation. Our next caller is Jessica in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Jessica.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to start out by saying I have a 9-year-old son who many years back could tell something was just not right, but we didn't know what was wrong. And I started seeking out people to help me figure out what the problem was. He was misdiagnosed with oppositional defiance disorder, and we didn't believe that that was necessarily the case. So we kept digging deeper and deeper and deeper. And after more research, we figured out that diet alteration was actually going to be the key to helping him. And it turned out he was truly allergic and reacting to particular foods. And what we did was, once we changed the diet, we just did behavior modification. We would say, now, in this situation, what would you do? How can we help you? What do you think you should do? And I just wanted to get your opinion on if you think food-related issues could be triggering some of this with these children.
Could it?
You know, my knowledge base on that, Jessica, is sparse. I mean, but I think you're raising a good point in terms of, let's start to look at the more common sense causes for a child's behavior before rushing to, you know, the more exotic medical causes. So, for instance, you know, there have been established links between caffeine and so that there's a link between caffeine, reduced sleep in children, and then problematic behavior that mimics ADHD. Children who overuse caffeine, then sleep less, can be ADHD-like. So, I'm thinking of a case right now where I was working with a child where, and this is fairly typical in my field, where a child was having difficulties sleeping at night, in the classroom, falling asleep, being checked out, not being productive in the classroom. And the doctor that I was dealing with wanted to order a sleep study, you know, going to the exotic medical cause, whereas, of course, my first question was, well, what's his caffeine intake like late in the afternoon? And sure enough, mm-hmm. you know, his father traveled a lot, and he was from a divorced family, and when he was with his during his father's time, he was just, there was no parent on hand just monitoring his caffeine intake, and, you know, and that was the real source of the problem right there. But, Jessica, you make a good point. Let's start with the obvious ones: diet, sleep, structure in the home, routines, good routines that support self-discipline in the home. It seems to me that that's where we need to start. Those are the questions that need to be asked. Are all of those things occurring before we leap to the more medical causes for a child's behavior?
Yes, thank you for calling, Jessica. So, Dr. Nalati, are you at all concerned that the pendulum could swing the other way, that children who really need help with bipolar disorder or ADHD, we're going to delay a diagnosis and take too long to properly medicate a child who truly has these disorders?
No, I believe the opposite of that, Joy. I think the more we get good at differentiating between kind of, you know, things like what is a difficult personality trait, what is a mismatch in the parent-child relationship, like a oil and water relationship between a parent and a child where their temperaments are such that they both rub each other the wrong way, and that's the real source of a child's, you know, symptoms. A child who's slow to mature, a child who's in a classroom where the demands are beyond their maturation level. You know, the better that we get, you know, clarify between what is, loosely speaking, normal versus abnormal, then all the money that's being misspent on treating children that don't really have these diagnoses, I think, could be used to beef up and bolster and expand services to children who really do have these disorders. So that's my perspective.
Sue on Facebook asks, can the doctor tell us when parents lost their sense of what normal childhood behavior looks like? And what is driving this disconnection between parents and children in our culture?
That's really interesting. And that's a question I get asked a lot. It's like, is what's normal for children changed in the 21st century such that we, you know, such that it's parent, like, parents have a hard time teasing apart, like, what to expect versus what is evidence of a disorder? I actually think that is the case. I mean, I think with the internet, and now I get kind of conservative in my perspective, with the loosening of kind of norms about how to express anger, for instance. If, you know, in my book, Back to Normal, I have a small subsection and a chapter that's called Rage is All the Rage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if you really step back and look at kind of mass media, I think there's much more in-your-face, radical, extreme ways in which anger is expressed, for instance, by characters in mass media that give children, that send subtle and not-so-subtle messages that it's okay to behave insanely when you're angry. And so I do think that the norms have changed, and, you know, tantrums, behavior probably a little bit more extreme in children, needs for self-control, needs for control and being kind of self-focused, probably a little bit more extreme. There's a great book called The Narcissism Epidemic by a psychologist called Jean Twenge that makes pretty convincing arguments for how children in this day and age are a little bit more narcissistic than the previous generation, that self-esteem is at an all-time high, that this generation of children, that there's you know, are more likely to be overconfident. They believe that they should know things without having to learn them. They believe that they should get special treatment just for being alive, and that maybe that's due to a generational trend in parenting, child-centered parenting, where there's been a focus on making children so precious and special and not wanting to have high standards of decor and self-control that we put on them, and that's created a generation of narcissistic children who are more willing to battle to get to have things go their way and expect things to go their way. And in my book, Back to Normal, I show how these narcissistic phenomena look a lot like ADHD.
Mm. Let's go to another caller, Desiree in Brandon. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy. I just wanted to share with the speaker. I have an experience. My 10-year-old child has ADHD and was diagnosed about 2 years ago. And it was a long journey and a very difficult struggle as a parent making the decision to actually medicate my child. And a lot of guilt is associated with it, a lot of fear that I was possibly going to be medicating my child when perhaps I was failing at being a good parent to him. I tried a lot of strategies, and eventually we did end up making the choice to medicate my son, and it was a life-changing experience. I regretted not doing it sooner. I mean, the anxiety that he felt trying so hard to perform and to behave well, he was chewing holes in his clothes, trying to concentrate in class and trying not to be disruptive. And I just don't want parents to hesitate going to the doctor if they're afraid that this is a problem that their child might be having.
Sounds like it was a lifesaver in her case, Dr. Nolati.
Yeah, Desiree, your story, I think, is, you know, a story that is common for me, that the fact that you agonized over it, though, Desiree, I think is a good thing. The fact that you maybe continue to agonize in some small ways is a good thing, where you're keeping an open mind in terms of just how your child grows and develops over time. If the medication works, then that's a great thing, I would say. That in most cases, though, what tends to happen over time is that there are short-term benefits to the medication. Then over time, things can get complicated where the medication stops working in the way that it once did. And so this agonizing, searching for solutions, experimenting with solutions, I think is a good frame of mind to be in, and to not be casual about this. Agonizing over the decision tells me, Desiree, that you love your son dearly and want the best for him, and that wouldn't want him to be taking medication unless he really needs it, and that you discovered that he really needs it.
Thank you, Desiree, for calling. So what would you like to see happen with our system in diagnosing these disorders? How can doctors reduce the misdiagnosis of childhood behaviors?
Mm-hmm. Couple of answers to that question, John. I mean, first off, I think we really need to look at the training and education of health professionals and mental health professionals, and build in a much more of a focus on child development. And not just a textbook knowledge, but get doctors out there in the field to hang out in preschools, be around normal children under stressful conditions, so that they have a palpable sense of what's normal these days. So there's that. Believe it or not, there's a study out of the University of Michigan that shows that 40% of pediatricians in the country haven't even had a rotation in pediatrics. So there's a lot that can be done nationally in the education and training of health and mental health professionals. But as a society, one of the big changes that I think needs to be made is that we have to have a wellness model for children, not just an illness model. And what I mean by that, and this gets back to what one of the first callers made reference to, we need to start, I think, at the preschool level and kindergarten level in the school system, providing sort of wellness mental health services to children. And I would define that as opportunities for active play, being able to bolster children's social and emotional development through having opportunities to play, training adults to be play specialists that can play with children in ways to help to boost their social and emotional development, build social skills, build better self-regulation, self-control, expressive mastery of emotion. I think that if we had that going on in the early grades and in preschool, we would have much fewer, that this tendency to misdiagnose and overdiagnose children would be corrected rapidly.
Let's take Nadine in Milwaukee now. Hi, Nadine.
Hi, I'm a school psychologist, and so this job of diagnosing often falls on my shoulders, and I agree with your speaker 100%. I have basically 2 points. One is parents really need to work with the school. Medication is not the be-all and end-all, but it's not okay to say, well, you know, it's your problem or I can't do anything about it. You got to do something. And if you don't want medication, which I agree with, then do something. Talk to the doctor. Look into biofeedback. Look into therapy. Look into maybe parenting skills. The second thing is when you talk about sleep, parents are not aware of how many of their kids are up at night playing video games, watching TV after their parents have gone to sleep. Get those out of the bedroom. Take away the power cords. But you don't know what your kids are doing at night.
Yeah, in our final minute, Dr. Nalati, do you agree?
I agree wholeheartedly. I think there needs to be a full team approach in dealing with children who are struggling. Medication is just one piece. Parenting, school-based services, I think there needs to be a whole team approach. And then and the issue of sleep, there is the research really shows that there is an awareness gap. 90% of parents think that their teenagers are getting good sleep when that's only true in about 50% of cases. So parents, go back to basics. If your child is exhibiting problem behavior, look at the more common sense reasons first, sleep, a structure in the home. Take out as much randomness as possible in terms of when you pick your child up from school, when you're available. Really go back to basics and put on your common sense cap.
Well, you certainly have struck a chord. Our lines have been busy all hour, and our time is gone. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Joy. It was a pleasure.
Enrico Nalati is a clinical psychologist who specializes in child and adolescent therapy and assessment and is the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Marika Saval for producing this program. Thank you for listening. Hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. And I hope you're with us tomorrow at this time when it's our regular Friday Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.